Next up on our agenda for today is an outstanding panel that will explore the intersection of technology and philanthropy. Now, in today's world, these two domains are really inextricably linked, if only by the giant fortunes that have recently been made in the fields of computer science and surrounding entrepreneurship. But today, the connection is actually becoming much deeper and more intellectual than that, as attitudes that have been used to build technology companies are now being ported over to the philanthropic domain and used to drive good, positive change in the world. People have remarked that we now live in the era of the revenge of the nerds, and effective altruism has been called by some generosity for nerds. So what does that mean? Well, in the past, industrialists who had made great fortunes may have been content, or perhaps they had no better option than to stamp their family name onto an endowed institution and hope for the best. Today's software-savvy entrepreneurs are a little bit more sophisticated and discerning as they apply their fortunes, and they want to use the same techniques, the minimum viable product, the short iteration cycles, and the controlled experiments, the same techniques that they used to grow their businesses in the philanthropic domain. And in turn, they are taking philanthropic questions back to technology and asking what types of technological advances perhaps can only be made if we have philanthropic support. What might only be possible if somebody is saying, how can I do the most good, and not necessarily, how can I make the most profit? So for the next hour, we'll explore the relationship between technology and philanthropy. Soon we'll have a panel of distinguished guests on stage. But first, it's my pleasure to welcome Jan Tallon, founding engineer of Skype, and before that, Kazaa, and most recently, founder of the Cambridge Center for Existential Risk and also the Future of Life Institute. He is live with us from his home in Estonia via the global communication platform that he helped create. Jan, thank you for joining us and welcome.
Good morning.
So it's great to have you here. Jan, you've had really an incredible life, and I think you embody the intersection of technology and philanthropy in a very interesting way. You grew up in the behind the Iron Curtain, and I remember you telling stories about playing around with mainframes as a kid and creating video games. Probably never could have imagined the success that you would have later in life, certainly with Skype. But there you were, still pretty young guy, having accomplished more than you could have imagined, and now faced with a question, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? So tell us how you thought about that process and how you've come to do the things that you're doing today from that moment.
Right. So, yes, my life has been very weird. And my thinking really has evolved over time. I remember, I think it was in 2011, I gave a talk, actually, where I kind of explained why I'm doing like weird sounding things like existential risk reduction. And sort of when I graduated Skype, I had like many options available to me, and they were sort of like typical. Like the options were, you know, become a serial entrepreneur, become an investor, become a donor, and not really kind of constrained donor. Like, I think the expectations were just like, as long as you're giving and you're feeling good about giving, that's okay. In 2008, I think, I stumbled upon the writings of Eliezer Yudkowsky, where he was making this crazy sounding point that the default outcome from artificial intelligence might not be good for humanity. So I, you know, that argument really caught my attention, and I started paying attention and investing in this. And I found this like small community of people trying to make themselves heard. And I thought that, well, this is probably something that I could help with. And this was really sort of the first diversion from my sort of otherwise predictable future as a serial entrepreneur and investor. And as I kind of dug myself deeper there, I found like a really fascinating argument that made me talk to philosophers for the last several years. And now my, you know, philanthropic strategy has been to sort of nurture what I call existential risk ecosystem. I've been giving money to about 10 different organizations and projects that are kind of either directly trying to address existential risks or indirectly doing effective altruism work. And I really been glad. In fact, like 5 years ago when I made the talk about my trajectory as a philanthropist, I kind of postulated, wouldn't it be great if there was something like effective altruism, like people who actually kind of, instead of being guided by their evolution-given instincts about what constitutes as good philanthropy, would actually think about what would make sense to do as a philanthropist.
That's fascinating. So one question that I wanted to ask as a follow-up is, obviously you're focused on the biggest issues, right? The possibility that artificial intelligence could be a bad outcome for humanity, and that would be obviously extraordinarily bad and needs to be addressed. How do you think about, or maybe this isn't the way that you approach the problem, but how do you think about the very speculative nature of that versus the more concrete here and now good that you could do if you said, I'll take all those resources and just put them into malaria nets, because I kind of know that that's like the baseline, you know, it's proven, it's validated, you know, people have really done their homework on this. How do you think about the speculative nature of the portfolio that you're backing versus the kind of sure thing bet that you'd have on the other side?
In some ways, it's very similar. And your question kind of seems to be hinting that similar to investing, like you can either go with some sort of surefire low volatility instrument that doesn't have much uncertainty, like some loans or something, or you can invest in startups that are kind of very high volatile volatility yet potentially higher expected average return projects. And I think it's the same thing in philanthropy. So, like myself, I've been kind of attracted to the high uncertainty, potentially very high payoff. I think because like I don't really see like very good counter arguments, against kind of focusing on the average expected outcome as opposed to like minimum good that I could do or something like that. So, and there is actually like a mathematical theorem called von Neumann-Morgenstern theorem that in order to be non-exploitable rational agent, you actually have to focus on the average expected outcome, not any other function. So that's one thing. And also like the, if you really start doing the numbers, I remember Nick Bostrom once told me that he was in some session with people you know, worried about various risks and trying to figure out how to increase world's resilience toward water supply problems and earthquakes and whatnot. And he said that, look, I did some like back of the envelope calculation here, and it looks like existential risks are about 10 to 40 times more important than anything you have talked about here when you kind of think about the long-term potential of humanity. So in some ways, I could, like, if that's these assumptions that went into his calculations are true, then I could like be off by like 20 or 30 orders of magnitude and still be kind of good. So in that sense, also it's like it seems like way more intellectually attractive to focus on topics that are like really really big picture and take you to sort of reliably take to philosophy like every opportune moment.
So at the end of the day, it's sort of Eliezer's old refrain, shut up and multiply and trust the numbers.
Yeah, or like the other example he uses, some bank robber who said that, like, why do you rob banks? Well, because that's where the money is.
Yeah, that's right. So speaking of where the money isn't and where it's going, you mentioned, you know, the obvious thing for someone in your position to do is to be an investor. You have not neglected that entirely. You are certainly an active investor. When you make for-profit investments, how do you think about the positive effects that those companies may have in the world? Are you more narrowly thinking about what's going to be a good business, or are you trying to create positive spillovers from the for-profit sector with your investments as well?
I'm certainly a little bit sensitive to positive impact, positive object level impact that companies could have. Like my usual refrain is that I'm interested in creating something or having people create something that they even can't buy. You can't buy with money now, regardless of how much money you have. That said, I don't pay that much attention to so-called like social impact enterprises because I'm kind of committed to giving vast majority of my, or at least majority of my potential returns from investment to X-risk reduction or EA courses anyway. So it's like those companies are going to have a significant impact whether they like it or not.
Gotcha. So it's sort of separation of concerns is the underlying philosophy there.
Yeah, indeed.
A question, maybe an unusual one, slightly more personal than your typical question here. You come from a small country, and Skype certainly was a phenomenal success that everybody, you know, everyone I've ever met from Estonia, you know, loves to claim Skype and talk about, you know, this came from our country. Yet, a little over a year ago, I had the chance to visit you there. You were nice enough to show us around a little bit. And I was really struck by the fact that in public, nobody really knows who you are. I think that's got to be a choice on your part. You could be much more public. You could be a celebrity if you wanted to be, certainly at home, if not internationally as well. But you've chosen to keep a pretty low profile and kind of just operate mostly under the radar. How do you think about that trade-off? Do you think being a celebrity could, in fact, help you accomplish more? Or is that all sort of a distraction in your view?
Yeah, it potentially could. And it's indeed, it is like a definite choice. Like, for example, in Estonia, I don't do TV interviews try to avoid people associating my face with my message. And, I generally kind of shy away from irreversible actions. And, like, becoming a celebrity seems to be, like, an irreversible action. So I would kind of trade away that choice. I remember, once in my life, I met Elon Musk, and we actually talked about this, and he said, like, yes, that's like unfortunate thing that he just can't go to a bar anymore because it's not that there's like a class of experiences that are no longer available to him because of the celebrity status. So that's definitely if I didn't so much care about the anonymity from my personal perspective, I'll probably do some sort of experiments, become a celebrity in some, like, locally and see, like, what happens or something like that. But I right now really care about passing as a common person.
Do you have anything in mind that you think, you know, this is kind of what would finally make me make that irreversible decision? You know, are there any sort of conditions you feel like, you know, as artificial intelligence comes closer, any thresholds that you've sort of set for yourself of when to go truly all in on getting your message and your concern out into the public?
Well, I think I'm getting my message and concern out anyway. So it's it seems to be going pretty well right now when it comes to voicing the X-risk concerns. And also interesting, I'm not actually even sure if it's what is the definite utility just trying to push the message to the public, really, especially when it comes to AI risk. Because like ultimately what it depends on are our technologists. And you, in some ways, it's kind of important to try to build consensus within the technology community and then perhaps go to public or kind of broaden the base of the opinion. Otherwise, making people defensive wouldn't be a good strategy, I think.
Yeah, and it, certainly the campaign to be thoughtful about artificial intelligence has come an amazingly long way over the last 5 years, thanks to you and obviously many others as well. Changing the topic a little bit, we don't have too much more time, but maybe at least one, maybe a couple more questions. There's a policy panel coming up here tomorrow where people from government and think tanks are going to get together and talk about the possibility to make a difference through the shaping of policy. You've had at least a touch of that experience in Estonia where, you know, I hazard to say that government is pretty good and pretty responsive. You've been an advisor to the president. What has your experience as an advisor to government taught you about policy, and how would you encourage us to think about what we may or may not be able to accomplish through policy?
Small correction there. In Estonia, the institution of president and government are two different things. So I was an advisory board of president. I think my exposure there was fairly brief to actually influence my worldviews there. I do think that in one thing that seems to be important is that especially in small country like Estonia, the sort of background of people, regardless of in what kind of government office they are, it seems to be really playing a big role. So, for example, the Estonian e-residency and electronic ID and electronic voting, all these initiatives, they can be actually kind of traced down to perhaps half a dozen or a dozen people. So it's really you can see how their life experience has been kind of bringing them to that point where they have gotten just increasing amount of positive feedback from the world, and then they basically found that, okay, this is something important that they could be working on, which I'm not sure if it kind of, you can kind of learn very generalizable lessons from this other than just people are important.
Yeah, certainly the size also of the institutions that you're working within probably make a huge difference. So to think about the relative scale of institutions and how hard they are to steer, something we might want to continue to talk about tomorrow. Just one more question for you. I think a lot of people in the room, certainly I've been thinking about this a lot recently, may have the feeling that the world is sort of pulling apart and more countries are sort of turning inward. Certainly there's a feeling of that in the United States. There's certainly a feeling of that in England, obviously, with recent events. You're somebody who, again, living in Estonia, very close to Russia, probably a very different perspective on that. Do you think about current events as something that you as a philanthropist should be concerned with at all, or are you only thinking about longer time frames?
Oh yeah, I'm very much thinking about it. And in fact, a year ago at Effective Altruist Global, EA Global in Oxford, I gave a talk about this very topic. So there is one kind of research project that I've been working on over the last 2 years, on and off, which is really thinking about how can we kind of stabilize the world? How can we kind of improve the coordination abilities? So for example, if you think about it, the League of Nations and United Nations, they were kind of established almost like a knee-jerk reaction to the world wars. So there wasn't much of, certainly not much of technological or game theoretic thought that went into this, into establishing them as far as I know. Whereas now, there are all sorts of global coordination technologies that are available to us, starting with internet and going to blockchain and all this increased transparency from constant monitoring from satellites, et cetera, et cetera. Can we actually think about how can we bring those new technologies onto the table and create coordination mechanisms that are just much better than the existing systems that we have globally, and thereby potentially actually get ourselves out of so-called bad Nash equilibriums, where we are kind of predictably doing silly things like arms races and things that lead to global warming or deforestation or existential risks.
Is this something that you're investing in any particular way by backing organizations or companies, or is this still in the sort of early idea phase for you?
It's fairly idea phase right now. I bought coordination.org.
First thing to do, always register the domain.
Yes. I've been working on this document that I hope to get to the phase where we can start kind of iterating in the larger circles, and then eventually, hopefully, it will end up on this coordination.org. That basically has three sections. One section is describing where humanity has before coordinated against sort of bad Nash equilibriums. The most prominent example, I think, is the fixing the ozone layer. Then the second section is looking at what kind of new technologies are kind of coming online or already online that might be helpful when it comes to solving coordination problems. And third section is just giving a few ideas, few examples, what could be done with this new technology that wasn't possible before.
Do you think of virtual reality as being one of those technologies to help people come together in a more intimate way across space?
Possibly. Like, I haven't actually analyzed virtual VR or augmented reality. No, I think I mentioned augmented reality, but not VR in this document yet. But like I said, it will be just, there will be many iterations of that. So if we figure out ways how to actually use that, then sure.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to reading that document, Jan. Jan Tallon, everybody, for joining us today and for your tireless work on behalf of all humanity, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to do a quick set change as we bring out our panel. So give us just 60 seconds to get chairs, and we'll be right back. All right. So we're ready to begin the panel on philanthropy and technology after I certainly enjoyed that talk with Jan. I hope you did as well. I'd like to introduce first to moderate the panel, Eric Torenberg. My pleasure to bring Eric to the stage. I can proudly say that I knew Eric back when he was working on an online rap battle platform in my hometown of Detroit, Michigan. Fast forward a couple years, and he is just coming off an outstanding run at Product Hunt, where, among other things, he nurtured an international community of product builders and product lovers, and also interviewed dozens of technology and thought leaders on the Product Hunt podcast. So please join me in welcoming Eric Torenberg to the stage. And our four panelists, starting with Katrien Verklaas. Katrien is the Director of Global Communications and Advocacy at Evidence Action, an organization that scales proven development solutions to benefit millions of people around the world. Just one example, they have a low-cost water chlorination system in production, now serving 5 million people in Africa. She has written widely on the impact of mobile phones on development and participation in civil society, and she has been a fellow at both TED and the MIT Media Lab. Please welcome Katrien. Next up, Howie Lempel. He is a program officer for the Open Philanthropy Project, a collaboration between GiveWell and Good Ventures that conducts in-depth philanthropic research and shares findings openly with the public. He's worked on causes including biosecurity and pandemic preparedness, criminal justice reform, potential risks of advanced artificial intelligence, and global poverty alleviation. He has worked for the Brookings Institution and various criminal justice reform organizations and is currently on leave, joining us here today from Yale Law School. Welcome, Howie. Gareth Spillane is next. He is the Chief of Staff and Vice President at the Global Innovation Fund, a London-based fund established to find, finance, and scale innovations in international development. Previously, he worked at 10 Downing Street as head of the Prime Minister's Appointments Unit, where he advised the Prime Minister on strategic, national, and international personnel issues, as well as on business and trade events and policy. He's also the chair of the European Alliance for Human Rights in North Korea and a member of the advisory board of the Future Talent Forum. Welcome, Gareth. And finally, Luke Nozick is here. He is a partner at Founders Fund, where he serves on the boards of SpaceX and ResearchGate. Previously, he was a co-founder of PayPal and the company's VP of Marketing and Strategy. And earlier still, he worked at Netscape and founded one of the internet's earliest ad networks. Please welcome Luke Nozick.
Thank you, Nathan, for the fantastic introduction. Wow. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Philanthropy and Tech panel. We have a great group of guests, and we're going to have a very interesting conversation. It's going to be very wide-ranging. It's going to touch on philanthropy and data, philanthropy and government, improving incentives, among other things. But before getting into the conversation, I want to give a chance for our guests to introduce themselves a little bit more and talk more about their work. So, Katrine, do you want to start us off?
Yeah. Thank you so much, and thanks all for being here. So Evidence Action is a relatively new organization that was specifically founded to scale up evidence-based, rigorously evaluated solutions cost-effectively. So we care about three things: evidence, scale, and cost-effectiveness. You may know one of our flagship programs, the Deworm the World Initiative, which focuses on deworming kids in order to increase educational and economic outcomes. We dewormed with the government of India, Kenya, Ethiopia, and a couple of others, 189 million children. Actually, it's going to be over 200 million children this year. So when I talk about scale, I mean big. Why am I on this panel? I come from the tech world. I ran a company, startup mobile data collection company, back in the day when mobile was still new, when there was no mobile penetration, and when data collection, particularly in the development space, global development space, was very, very unproven. So I am super interested in evidence and data and the right size technology to achieve that in order to make smart decisions.
Hey, everybody. So I work at the Open Philanthropy Project. And we are also a relatively new organization. We're a foundation, and our goal is to do as much as we can to improve folks' lives in expectations. So we sort of have this expected value framework, which means that we're willing to take risks, in the hopes of a very large payoff. It's fairly similar to the way that some venture capitalists talk about their model. And so when we think about philanthropy and technology, one of the things that we think really hard about is what are things that philanthropists can do that other actors aren't in as good of a position to do. We believe that the best opportunities for philanthropy are usually going to be areas that are neglected for some reason by other actors. And so as philanthropists, some things that we are able to do is, number one, absorb a lot of risk. Governments, which are also big actors in a lot of the spaces we're interested in, often are working on a political cycle that means that you can't have a large number of failures. We're also able to think in the very long run, so we can give to technologies that might not have a payoff for years or even decades. We can think globally and be sort of global cosmopolitans. And we can also invest in technologies that might only pay off in certain fairly unlikely situations. So those are the types of things that we think about when we're trying to figure out what might be a good technology for a philanthropist to invest in as opposed to a for-profit company or as opposed to governments. So those are some thoughts for now.
Was the acronym OPP inspired by, in part, by the rap song?
I would like to say we were inspired by the rap song, but we actually realized that the acronym was already in use after we had come up with the idea, but we decided that there were enough people who had moved past the 90s that we could share it and we'd be okay.
Yep. I'm still there.
Yeah. Aren't we all?
I'm from the Global Innovation Fund, which is also new. We were set up with financing from the US, UK, Australian, Swedish governments, and the MIDI network to incubate, to evaluate, and to test investment-ready innovations that, if proven to work, we could then scale and have a positive impact on the lives of millions of the world's poor, especially those earning under $5 a day, and even more especially on those living under $2 a day. We are a social returns first development VC designed to operate beyond the remit of our donor governments. Basically, our focus is to take more risk than governments can to back things where we can see a social return and the generation of evidence that we have sort of broader ramifications across development. We are slightly different from other players in the market. We do some grant funding at any stage through pilot, test and transition, and potentially scaling. But we also do use various financial instruments, including loans, convertible debt, and equity. We have an open window, so anyone, anywhere can apply for any project in the developing world. You know, academics can apply to us, NGOs, and also for-profit companies. We want to see social returns first and foremost, but equally, you know, we know that some of the innovations we back will be those winners that deliver 10x financial return as well. As well as our broad sort of no specific geography, we have no specific sectors we focus on. Though that said, we can pick up sort of thematic areas we think are interesting, whether it be remittances and making the remittance markets work better, whether it be displaced people and fragile states, or whether it be a theme like domestic resource mobilization, where we think that new and innovative approaches can have major impacts socially for the world's poorest.
Gareth, was the acronym GIF inspired partly by GIF or GIF?
It was. We were, yeah. I mean, it was basically the whole reason we were set up.
Yeah. Luke, would you like to?
So, Luke Nosek, I'm a partner and a co-founder of the Founders Fund. We started about 10 years ago with a mission to support entrepreneurs that are bringing breakthrough technologies to bear on some of the world's most pressing problems. And what we found is that this is the way for us to also create the greatest returns for our investors, which number sort of the traditional institutional investors. What unifies us and our entrepreneurs are the similar mission orientation of our fund and their companies. And and yet it is not always clear in the beginning where some of the greatest positive good can take place. A company like Facebook, which has, I believe, a positive mission when we were early investors, originally started out when Mark was 19, not having thoughts about that. And a company like SpaceX, where I'm also an investor and sit on the board, was originally started as a philanthropic project to try to put a greenhouse on Mars and, as Elon described, buy off by Russian ICBMs off the market to cheaply pay for all of this. But he decided that the way to do it was ultimately to build a for-profit company. So the thing I'm most curious about in discussing here is these entrepreneurs have done tremendous positive good with the force of technology and using capitalism. And some of them also have worked in the worked in the nonprofit area, as I have myself. But the question is, how do you how do you actually create a motivation structure, either within a for-profit enterprise, to keep the focus on the mission of the company and its ultimate goals? And how do you create a motivation structure within a nonprofit enterprise to keep it on its original mission and goals? And I think it's by no means trivial to figure out how to do this. So I'm looking forward to the conversations about this, and thank you for having us.
Let's start right there. Luke, why don't you kick us off? When should you, when having philanthropic aims, when should you look at for-profit models, and when should you look at nonprofit models?
So one thing, and I'm going to admit a bias I have from having most of my life being spent building companies, is that the motivation alignment, although it seems it's easier to do in a nonprofit context, like, oh, here I'm starting this organization to cure malaria around the world. Well, obviously, everyone who joins me is going to be intrinsically motivated by curing malaria, but and my investors will be motivated and donors by the same thing. But that's just what they say they are motivated by. How do you know and how do you check that's what they're motivated by, and how do you check whether they're going to stay that way over time? So you have that issue with a nonprofit as well. How does Elon Musk check whether everyone is interested in Martian colonization or whether they just like the stock options and think rockets are cool? There's probably a large mixture of those people at SpaceX. But there's a fallback with for-profits. It doesn't exist with nonprofits, and that is there's the fallback of the profit motive and of the status you get from that success, and then also the payments you get from your customers, which give you feedback that you are getting closer to some kind of goal and providing something for them. And so if your motivation structure is not perfectly defined, as I don't think it is at a SpaceX, it still keeps going. Whereas in a nonprofit, if your motivation system is not perfectly working, the whole thing can fly apart or actually just turn into a dark force for something else you don't want, as many older nonprofits have become. Not to say it doesn't happen within the big multinationals as well. I think we need to solve this problem in both cases. But I just want to note that it's not automatically solved because you have a nonprofit. You have to figure out how to keep people motivated and on the same mission. And I want to figure out ways of doing that better in both of those cases.
Howard, you were talking about earlier, we had a very heated conversation. It was almost a fist fight. It broke out.
Don't have a fist fight.
about the importance of the nonprofit structure and when should we, what are your opinions there?
Yeah, I think Luke definitely has a point that profit can serve as this fallback motivator. One issue there is that only works when you have a mission that can be aligned with your company being profitable. And so some of the areas where we've thought about funding technology are areas where it's particularly difficult to think of a profit model. And so in one of the fields that I've spent the most time on is biosecurity and preparation for potential pandemics. And that's an area where a lot of folks think that developing countermeasures that wouldn't be useful in day-to-day health, but might be useful in sort of a low probability scenario where we have a really bad pandemic, is the type of thing that would be really hard to profit from. Any given countermeasure, it might be very unlikely that there will ever be a need for it, that there will ever be a use. And in the event of a really bad pandemic, it's not clear that the company would have an easy time profiting anyway. So there are some government models for guaranteeing a market in that case, but you need, I think, some type of structure other than just profit as the motivation in cases like that. And I agree with Luke's point that motivation really is very important, and I think it's something that sometimes it's easy to miss when you're thinking really hard about, what's the best intervention, what ideally would we like somebody to be doing. And I think philanthropists, when they're doing a good job, are also thinking really hard about Do I know of, or can I find, a really motivated person to work on this problem? And that can often be the limiting factor.
Can I say something to the, as the nonprofit, the non-donor, non-profit? So I think there's a golden triangle. So our work is very much based on evidence that academics and researchers gather in often long-running randomized control trials. And then we obviously rely on funding from donors, from individual donors as well as institutional donors. But we also rely very much on particularly technology companies and for-profit companies to provide us with services that we frankly suck at running ourselves, and we shouldn't, right? So let me give you an example. So we are in, as a field and us as an organization, in need of as close to possible real-time accurate data that allows us to make decisions. We have a project in Bangladesh that focuses on, it's just emerging, just starting, it focuses on seasonal hunger and seasonal income insecurity of very poor rural workers who during what's called the lean season, when the harvest hasn't come in, go hungry, there's no work, and where families suffer. Seasonal income insecurity is a global phenomenon in Bangladesh and in parts of Southeast Asia, it's particularly astute. So interesting researchers at Yale University did a study that looked at if you subsidize a $10 or $20 bus ticket for a rural worker, rural non-subsistence worker, to migrate during those 3 months of the lean season to a bigger labor market, which usually is a city, you can increase caloric income, caloric consumption of every member of the family by something like 750 calories a day, which is an additional meal during that lean season. So hunger goes away, and income increases as well significantly, and it allows the family to basically stay in their agricultural setting, preventing sort of large-scale urban migration. Potentially, we don't know. We don't absolutely know this. But so there's equilibrium effects, right? If too many people move to the city, wages go down there, and prices can possibly rise in the origin village. There's difficult decisions to be made as to how many people should be migrating, how many people should we be subsidizing, from which target areas. And so we need a lot of real-time data. It is extremely hard to get that. We shouldn't be gathering it, right? We should be working with companies that actually have this figured out, right? There's a company here in San Francisco called Premise that is trying to do that, you know, ground sourcing price and wage data. Difficult, and, you know, haven't quite figured it all out, but there's absolutely no reason why we should be doing this ourselves and shouldn't partner with an organization like that or a company like that, and sort of have this kind of perfect triangle understanding motivations of the various different parties, but getting real-time data or as close to real-time data as possible to allow us to make decisions about our programs supported by donors based on evidence by academics. So I'm not sure that the organizational, you know, IRS destination is going to matter altogether that much in that instance.
What's preventing you from having the partnerships with these companies to the extent that you would like right now? What are roadblocks or barriers?
So real-time data for decision-making is still in its infancy. We're stuck in the 90s here, right? Like, you'd think in the age of smartphones and 100% mobile penetration, we'd be there. There is an organization here at Berkeley called SIGA, which is doing some really interesting work to actually look at the role of technology and data in particular in evidence-based programs. I think there's a panel later on this afternoon that you should all go to if you're interested in this. So there's, for instance, around rural electrification related a project that looked both at satellite data but then ground sourced it to verify actual because a lot of people live off grid, even though there is a grid, to actually see what is the rural electrification house by house by house. You know, I think the ability to gather good, statistically significant, high-quality data in a reliable, cost-effective way is still, it's the holy grail, hasn't been figured out. So I think in some areas there's a lot of progress, but as the guys at Premise can tell you, a lot of this is really, really hard. We did a project with Premise in Kenya, and it was a mixed bag. It was some really good data and some not so good data. And so, you know, I mean, I'd love to talk to you all later on. If you all figure this out, or somebody's figured this out, you know, let's chat. But it's not a solved problem.
Do you have a follow-up thoughts to just the intersection of data and philanthropy and what you guys are seeing in your respective organizations?
Data would be amazing to have. High-quality data would be amazing to have in philanthropic endeavors. And in the for-profit world, you know, again, we have a really cheap fallback, which is we have accounting. And it's almost like a pejorative because it's so boring because it's always there. And if in the philanthropic world we also had accounting, I think many of us here are trying to do that, and you're trying to do that, that would be fantastic.
And the opportunity is huge. You know, as data flows grow, you know, we should be pooling information and, you know, focusing on target areas, whether it be agricultural yield or primary education or whatever. And that's when we'll have real impacts on key issues of global poverty.
So there's a whole concept around data philanthropy. I'm actually curious what you think about that. So data philanthropy, and there's an organization called UN Global Pulse, which is sort of this incubation data lab of the UN, that is sort of advanced this idea of data philanthropy. And so that would be large, big data, such as mobile data around population movements, for instance, that companies donate to particular organizations with, you know, privacy restrictions, et cetera, in order to understand, for instance, you know, the onset of famines, right? People start to move when there is no food. And often these are sort of early signals that indicate that something is up, that they can be verified on the ground, et cetera. But so this whole concept started kind of in 2014. Data philanthropy was sort of hot, you know, big data, whatever. But I haven't really sort of seen this come to fruition in a big way that actually is, you know, real and actionable. There's the Polaris project. I mean, there's a lot of this sort of bubbling up, but from your point of view, where do you see that? Where is it at, and where's it going? Sorry, you're the moderator.
No. This is what I want. Thoughts, remarks?
I think one issue that might sort of connect the technology issues and the data philanthropy issues is, in my experience, networks are really important. And so there are a lot of cases where even if a nonprofit has a mission, that nonprofit also has to rely on for-profits to do that mission. And for-profits can profit by selling to nonprofits. But markets don't get created by magic, and somehow folks need to find out that there's demand for a specific product. And I think sometimes the nonprofit sector, the public sector, doesn't have the same sort of like day-to-day contact with the technology world that the for-profit sector does, and that can mean that its needs don't get met as well. I mean, again, just sort of going back to an area that I know relatively well, it's sometimes been an obstacle in the area of epidemic response. Because a lot of the technologists and scientists who will develop some diagnostic or some kind of treatment or vaccine, they might get 90% of the way there. And then there's the additional question of, now how do we modify it so it can be used in a developing world context. And it's the kind of thing that's hard to automatically do right if those connections don't exist and if you're not really in touch with the folks on the ground who are going to use your product in that particular way.
I think one of the opportunities is, you know, we live, all of us, in a very data-rich environment, and there is a data market. I mean, I can buy data on anybody in this room, essentially. And that's what we need to create. We need to crowd in a market in the developing world with the potential to do precisely that. You know, there are market opportunities. You know, there are opportunities for non-profits and for-profits. And, you know, the more data we can have accessible to organizations across the board, you know, that's when we'll realize the potential of this.
I think something else that philanthropy can do that's often hard for other entities to do is provide for public goods that are needed by, you know, all of the organizations in some particular for-profit space. And so one thing that we've thought about in a bunch of different fields is governance of emerging technology. And we've thought a lot about, you know, particular technologies that we expect to be really beneficial but might have some risks, and how do we address that?
Which technologies?
So in particular, I mean, we've thought a lot about risks related to biology, you know, so certain research with pathogens that could, you know, both be beneficial and present a danger. Also risks sort of as AI gets much more advanced than it is right now. But more broadly, going back to the data issue, I think if we're going to have a world where we have this marketplace in data, you know, people are going to have concerns about this data. And so something that I think the philanthropic and nonprofit sector is well positioned to do is to think ahead about those concerns. If we want to have this data put to good use, we also need to think about, you know, privacy issues and how are we going to make sure the public is comfortable with this data being out there. It's the kind of thing that all organizations using data benefit from, and so there's a reason to think that it might be sort of underprovided by markets.
And also a key role for governments in that as well.
Let's talk a bit more about sort of the intersection of philanthropy and government. Gav, do you want to talk a little bit about your guys' work and what you guys have done?
Sure. So GIF was inspired by other models, including DIV at USAID, but with the view to having a very global approach. We work with four governments at the moment. The US, the UK, Sweden, and Australia, each of which have got different motivations for being involved with GIF. But what the commonality across those governments is, governments tend not to take risk with public money. But by sort of taking a bet on something like GIF, what they're able to do is sort of outsource sensible, informed risk-taking and the driving of evidence. And there's a broader political narrative in that, of course. For too long, some government aid and ODA spending has gone on programs and initiatives that aren't backed by the evidence or simply don't work. So part of our model is about collecting the evidence to be able to say, well, this works. What we now need to do is scale it, continue to evaluate it, but let's deliver real impact. And when initiatives don't work, to look at the interventions needed to either take them out of the market or make them fit the market more appropriately. But, you know, that evidence point is absolutely key. We need to have an evidence-led aid market governmentally, but also work with philanthropists and with NGOs on really being evidence-driven. Because, you know, we want to be, you know, funds like us need to be entrepreneur-led. And key to that is understanding the evidence, understanding how to gather evidence, and understand how to use it to inform decision-making across the sector in which we all work.
Luke, when you guys at Founders Fund invest in companies, besides thinking about their return, how do you analyze sort of their impact on the world from a non-financial perspective?
You know, this is a great question. We always try to understand the motivation of the entrepreneur for doing the company. And again, we're not dogmatic about it. There's some cases where, in fact, one was working with the company last week, and we're probably going to invest, where, as far as I can tell, his motivation is only to make his industry better, only to make his service customers. But it's a very strong and positive one, and we support that as well. But the ones where we are the most enthusiastic about is when we find, oh, you've thought, you know, you really want to have this huge impact on humanity, and you've thought through a plan for how to do it, and it aligns perfectly with, you know, we mentioned, is it aligned with the company and its profit-making enterprise? Yes, if it's aligned very well, that is the kind of thing that we want to do. So it's mainly by checking why they're doing it and making sure that, that's the reason, rather than by, you know, measuring it in any kind of specific way.
If your co-founder, Peter Thiel, was sitting at this table with us, what very interesting viewpoint might he add to the conversation? What do you think he might suggest or say regarding philanthropy and technology?
Well, it's impossible to simulate Peter Thiel. He's the most, maybe the most brilliant person I know. But one way you can do it is by just saying extremely contrarian and strange things. So maybe something like, we're doing too much philanthropy. And what I might mean by that, again, I'm not putting words in his mouth, is that what's the most effective way to measurably and in a long term achieve what we're trying to do? And he does a lot of philanthropy, but he does a lot more investing than philanthropy. And I know him fairly well, almost 20 years. He's really trying to do the most good that he can. So that's just how he's found that where he can have the greatest effects is, you know, mostly through funding these entrepreneurs who have technological projects that have a for-profit component, and some through some of the nonprofits, many of which are, you know, in this room.
Cool. I want to ask a sort of difficult question. A lot of this relates to sort of trade-offs and you know, where you put your resources. If you were sort of magically, this question for everyone here, if you, after this conversation, you happen to look at your bank account and saw $10 billion in it, and wanted to distribute that money for, you know, the most philanthropic aims you can think of to see the world that you want to live in, what would you do with that money besides give it to your organization? Anyone? Jump in.
So actually, I would give it to, so there's this project called Goldilocks. We obsess a lot about this right-sized approach to data and analytics and technology. Goldilocks is a collaboration amongst a number of players: Google, Center for Effective Global Action here at Berkeley, Innovations for Poverty Action, to help the nonprofit social good sector impact programs, impactful and evidence-based programs, to right-size this issue of data analysis technology and evaluation, sort of ongoing evaluation to figure out what works. And I think there's a really promising way to think about it. I think it needs big money. So my money is going to be on that. Also, I love this stuff, so there.
If I had the answer, I'd be trying to get Open Philanthropy to fund the organization. So I don't know that I have a really good answer there, and my day job is to help our organization answer that question. I think that one thing that we've learned as a new foundation is just the importance of really getting to know a space well. And so I think, like, it's hard to talk about spaces where we haven't sort of met all the people, learned about what other people are doing, trying to avoid replicating stuff that governments or other philanthropists or the for-profit sector are already working on. So I don't have a great answer. You can look on what I'm working on to get some sense of what that answer is. I think that pandemics, both natural pandemics, also sort of down the road as biotech potentially gets both broader and more advanced, the idea of engineered pandemics, is a really big risk that the globe ought to be paying a lot of attention to. So I'm really excited about funding folks who are working on that problem.
I was in Kenya 2 weeks ago, seeing the work of Evidence Action on the ground, specifically the water, their safe water program. And it was inspiring and it was brilliant. It's an amazing project and a great example of evidence being taken to scale. Reflecting on that, and quite how inspiring it was, you just remember that, there are these ideas on which we pilot and which we test and which we get evidence that shows, this can be genuinely impactful and this might be the thing that makes, the hugest difference to the lives of the world's poor. So I'm lucky to work for an organisation that does a bit of that, but we're not the only one. So I'd put the money toward any organisation with that aim of finding the innovations that, if proven, can, materially change the face of global poverty. I would also probably adopt a whole lot, probably hundreds of dogs. And we can't forget that, donors are driven in some way by the things that make them happy. So a little bit of the money would be put aside for that.
I'll take it and I'll have a puppy too.
One of the things I've learned from Peter and even more particularly from Elon Musk is to not disperse my efforts too far and to pick one or two things. And Elon, of course, has picked space and energy and now AI, which he's worked on together with Google DeepMind and with the his OpenAI initiative. And Peter has Founders Fund primarily and a few other things. The one piece that I think is not being done that I am the most passionate about, if I had several $1 billion, would be to build a city. And I don't know, and I don't think it matters if it's a city in international waters like Peter Seasted, or if it's a city on Mars like Elon Musk's colony. I don't think it matters if it's in the United States or if it is in the developing world. But I think it is absolutely critical that there, because I believe there are some ways in which not just our physical infrastructure is crumbling and not suited at all to technological development in our cities, but I think our societal and cultural institutions are crumbling as well. And the opportunity to put people together, to put the most innovative and entrepreneurial and altruistically minded people in one single place, in a different kind of infrastructure, in a different kind of environment, I think could move humanity forward significantly. And I hope it could be done in a way that is also for profit, so it could be repeatable. You don't just build one city, but you convince the real estate industry that, again, cities could be built from scratch anew on this type of paradigm.
I would like to be a beta user of a new city. What is the biggest barrier? It's been tried, it's being tried, it's currently... What's holding it back right now?
So there's a few people that have been talking about Google. Actually, 10 years ago, I think I was in a hot tub with the Google founders, and they just got their significant wealth, and what would you do if Larry's like, I want to build a city. This happens over. Then recently, Sam Altman said he wants to fund building cities. One of his partners mentioned at Y Combinator. But the problem, I believe, is that they're all thinking purely about the technological infrastructure, not about the cultural infrastructure. And the barrier is to think outside our culture. What elements, what new types of culture would you build? What elements of very ancient cultures would you bring into the new? And figuring out a way both to even think about this is very hard, because some of, culture is very politically correct. It's like only our culture is sort of okay. You don't even want to go too far into other things or things from the way past. They start to get very weird. but I want to have a scientific approach to this and actually experiment and try things to find out what works best for, you know, for Homo sapiens and whatever Homo sapiens is going to evolve to or transform to.
Not to get too off the rails for a second, but Ezra Klein from Vox has written that he believes that Peter Thiel's endorsement of Trump is actually a belief in what he called accelerationism or something, where
let's go down the drain faster.
Yeah, the institutions will die sooner, so that there's more room for these types of experiments, and more political and cultural, you know, will to rebuild and, you know, start from scratch in some areas. How do you think about that theory?
Well, I've never faulted Peter for doing something different. I don't know.
That's a good answer. we have a few minutes left, but I want to, you guys have been in philanthropy for quite a while, or the intersection of philanthropy and tech. I'm curious, this is for any and all of the panelists, what is something that you have changed your mind about, or something that you used to fervently believe that you now see as misguided in some way in the field, or broadly within philanthropy and tech?
So I used to think, when I started in mobile data, 2004, when most of you didn't have a phone, I assume, that, you know, this was going to solve the world and world poverty. And it made a dent. However, there is no such thing as a killer app. And even though technologists in many cases, in Silicon Valley in particular, is going to try to sell you that, change is incremental. That said, though, there is a real, and we are, you know, just north of Silicon Valley, there's a real sort of ethos that has permeated, I think, the effective altruism field that stipulates that big problems are solvable, and that is coming very much from an ethos of, you know, the moonshots and the ability to solve stuff. And so, you know, I don't think there's a killer app, but at the same time, I do believe that most problems in the short run are human problems, but in the long run, they're actually technology problems. Chop that.
Something that I have over time grown to appreciate is the importance of, as a philanthropist, thinking about the effects your philanthropy will have on other actors. So, you know, I've actually only been in philanthropy for a relatively short amount of time, but it's definitely the case that a several billion dollar foundation sounded much bigger to me 5 years ago than it does today. And so having some appreciation for the fact that that's an incredible amount of money, but philanthropy will always be small relative to the size of governments and relative to, you know, even the funding that's available for a lot of for-profits, is something that was a surprise to me and made me think a lot harder about what limitations philanthropy has and the importance of finding ways to, you know, leverage the work that governments and for-profits are doing and potentially help them to do their jobs well.
Two quick things. First, picking up on that government point, and also I come from government before I joined GIF. First thing would be, policymakers don't often understand what technology actually is. They think it's an iPhone or they think it's Facebook, and it's so much more. And in a development setting, it has so much potential to be so much more than that. So I think there is a role for philanthropists and for industry in speaking with government to really define what technology is and what the opportunities are. And then secondly, tech fixes in a development context don't tend to work if they're sort of delivered in isolation. You need to create the the broader kind of environment, the social, the behavioral change that goes along with it, to make adoption really work. Technology merely amplifies pre-existing abilities. You know, the better educated, the better networked, will gain more from technology, even in the developing world. You know, so we have to be realistic about that, acknowledge it, and then harness the power of technology to deliver real development impact.
So I used to believe that clearly the best way to positively impact the world was directly through creating a technology in the form of a company and or perhaps in investing in it. But there are so many other levers that may even be upstream of this one. It may be that creating a new philosophy changes how entrepreneurs are developing technology. It may be a new political system and changing that world. It may be a new understanding of humanity, a new understanding of psychology or sociology. And it can come from for-profit or non-profit. So it's one of the reasons I've been the most excited in participating and supporting the effective altruism movement is to discover all of these different ways we can impact the world positively. And I really appreciate the chance to do that.
Cool. I have a couple more questions, but I want to give people in the audience a chance. If you have a specific question for one of the panelists or the whole group, you should tweet me at Eric Tornberg, and I will look at it in real time. And if it's very interesting, I will ask it. So it's E-R-I-K-T-O-R-E-N-B-E-R-G. So here's my question. What have we not talked about here in terms of one of the biggest challenges you guys are facing right now or you think is an underrated element into philanthropy and tech that we have not addressed or is not being addressed enough in the national conversation?
I think one thing we haven't talked very much about, although Luke just kind of gestured at the importance of things like philosophy or like culture change. And I think there's one approach to thinking about philanthropy and technology where you think really hard about specific problems and what technology might solve it. But you're never going to come up with all of them. And so I think another thing that we haven't talked about is like what kind of culture do we want or need among folks who are coming up with technology so that philanthropists aren't in the position of constantly problem solving. And as somebody who works on risks related to emerging technology, sometimes there's a bit of a tension where you sort of feel like you're on the opposite side of the philanthropists. Philanthropists are worried that you're going to push for regulations that are going to, harm their industry. That's, not something that we want at all. We've talked a lot about all of the benefits technology can have. And so thinking of ways where, technologists can be helped to all sort of push in the right direction and what that looks like, something that we didn't talk about, but I think is really important.
Great note to close. Nathan, you want to take it back?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're out of time, so I don't know if you can hear. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
I don't know if you can hear my microphone, but lunch is going to be served immediately in the courtyard right behind us. To our fabulous panelists, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be back here at 2:20, so you've got an hour and 20 minutes for lunch. Thank you very much, guys, again. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thank you.